Morning. If you're visiting with us, we've been spending a better part of the year in the Gospel of Mark. And if you've been here through that, you know it's been pretty interesting. I think for a lot of us, it's been like reading something again for the first time when you kind of concentrate on a text, on the whole story of one of the gospel writers. If you're kind of jumping in with us visiting, and you're going to be here again, we hope, there are links on our website to some of the past teachings, and I think that that'd be really helpful. A lot of them have been really instructive for folks. So, and I say that I didn't give them all, so I can say that. It's not like I'm saying, like, oh, listen to me or whatever. And this is a really interesting story because I think, first off, when you read it, right, it's a little perplexing. My guess is for most of you, like, if I said, like, what's your favorite Bible verse, right? You don't say Mark 12, 18 through 27, right? Or like somebody's graduating and you don't give them like a little journal for Christian graduates with this Bible verse on the cover or something, right? I think it's got a pretty unique function, though, like in Mark's story. So we look at it in light of like how Mark's trying to give us a picture of who Jesus is. It's really interesting. And also, I think, even if you haven't read the Gospel of Mark before, it gets at some of the questions about the nature of life, life after death, the nature of human hope, that whether or not you're really familiar with Mark or whether or not you're really familiar with like the Christian story, that you probably can't get away from, right? And you've probably thought about before. I came across a passage last year when I was reading a book by a guy named Robert Harrison, who has, like, I think the best podcast, like, on the web. It's called Entitled Opinions. He teaches, like, Dante, Italian literature or something at Berkeley. But he has this podcast on lots of different issues and stuff. He's a very conversational guy. But in a book he wrote, he was reflecting on the nature of human happiness in the body. He says this: for human beings, happiness outside of the body is very difficult to imagine and impossible to desire. We can desire deliverance from the body and desire it very ardently, but that's another matter. The best proof of this, in my mind, is the fact that the beatified souls, the saints in Dante's paradise, anticipate with a surplus of joy the resurrection of their flesh at the end of time. One could say that their bliss in heaven is incomplete. In fact, until they recover in time what time has robbed them of, namely, their personal identities, which were bound up with their flesh. So as I tell my students sometimes when I teach Dante, all of us on earth, insofar as we are in our bodies, are more blessed than the saints in Dante's heaven. That's a really kind of probably controversial passage, and I don't know why the alignment is so whacked, but I love that line, until we recover in time what time has robbed us of. I think that some of this, the insights here in Harrison's passage, are touched on in this passage in the Gospel of Mark. So before we get into our teaching, would you pray with me this morning? Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, you who are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So I think we see like three things in this text, three things that go on. First, there's this immediate rebuke followed by a very reasoned response. And lastly, there's a radical hope. So if you're sort of a person that likes outlines, there's the outline: immediate rebuke, reason, response, radical hope. Now, before we get into the nature of the rebuke, I love that word, too, rebuke, right? It's just not a word we really use as contemporary moderns anymore. We don't say, I rebuke thee or anything like that, but it's a great word. We have to get a picture of who the Sadducees are, right? Jesus is often in combat, at least rhetorically, right, with a group called the Pharisees, right? The Pharisees are always challenging him, especially in Mark. Why did you heal on this day? Or by what right do you claim to reinterpret the law, right? Or why are you doing this, right? The Pharisees are always challenging him regularly in the Gospel of Mark. Then there's this group called the Sadducees that are part of the story too. Here they come and they ask Jesus this really strange question, right, about the resurrection and seven wives and all this sort of thing, right? It's like sort of the reverse of Big Love or something, right? The woman with seven husbands. No HBO watchers here. But to give you some background, I want to take a look at, there's a couple passages we could look at, but we'll just quickly look at Acts 23, verses 6 through 8. And this is where Paul is in a dialogue here with a group of Jews, the Sanhedrin, both Jews, both Sadducees and Pharisees. And the writer tells us that when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. So, you see, the Sadducees were an aristocratic priestly class, right? They were, at the risk of oversimplification, right? And if you want, like, Professor Olaf, after church, could maybe, John, could you draw like a chart for us with Sadducees, Pharisees? Absolutely. All right. I like a nice chart. But for the sake of oversimplification, think of the Sadducees as the aristocratic establishment, right? They are an aristocratic class, many of them involved in a kind of inheriting of the priesthood, you know, the authority of the temple. And they have a kind of de-supernaturalized faith. Right, they only believe in the first five books of Moses, right, the Torah. Right, so they don't acknowledge the entirety of what we would say is in our Old Testaments as canonical, as part of the Bible. Right, and they reject again like certain beliefs that had become pretty popular by the time of Jesus, in particular, the resurrection. Right? Now, to give you a sense of the resurrection's popularity, I was thinking of passages, and for some of you that are familiar with John's gospel, the story of the raising of Lazarus, right, where Jesus hears about his friend Lazarus who's died, and Lazarus is survived by two sisters, Mary and Martha, and Jesus seems to be almost taking his time to get there. When he arrives at their home, he first has an encounter with Martha, and their conversation goes like this. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." So Martha here is a good Jewish woman whose beliefs here reflect what the Pharisees believe too, that at the end of history, that God would bring about a day of judgment and healing and restoration, and that the righteous, that those who would be gathered together into God's presence and glory would be resurrected, re-embodied on the last day. Now, I was reading a rabbinical source, like, actually, people were asking, well, in the Jewish diaspora, what if I, as a Jew, am, you know, buried in outside of Rome or something, because I, you know, in the diaspora after the multiple conquerings of Israel, Jews wound up all over the place. What happens to my bones? How will God resurrect me to Jerusalem? And the rabbi said, well, actually, there's this underground tunnel system that when your bones get buried, the tunnels run from all over the world to Jerusalem. So it's like the bank, you know, when you pull up to TD Bank or whatever and you put your check in, it goes like, now, okay. As modern people, that's silly. We laugh, come on, you know, God doesn't work like TD Bank. Although TD Bank's great. I mean, there are a lot of institutions that should work more like TD Bank. But it just goes to show you, right, how significant the hope in the resurrection of the body was. Right? If you believe that the afterlife is just some sort of shedding off of this mortal coil, right, and your soul goes on, then you wouldn't ask questions like this. Right? But it's clear that the hope of many Jews in the first century was very different than that. It was a hope not just for the shedding off of the body, but for the renewal of the body, right? The healing of the body and the healing of the world. Now, again, the Pharisees believed this. The Sadducees didn't. And again, they didn't believe in angels. And there was a lot of supernatural things that they don't believe in. Now, the idea of the resurrection is pointed at in the prophets, right? But they don't acknowledge the prophetic text as canonical. So you had this dispute, right, between the Pharisees, who are a little more probably religiously and theologically, they probably have the sentiments of the average people, their heads, their hearts, they probably have them a little more than the Sadducees do. Right, so you have a division in class, a division in theology. So you could think of the Sadducees as this elite aristocratic class who have this sort of de-supernaturalized faith. Now, if that's too much, like, intellectually to hang your hat on, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm to classes and theology and canonical. Ashley Warren reminded me of something that she learned growing up, that if you have to remember the differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, you just remember the Sadducees, they're sad, you see, because they don't believe in the resurrection. So they have no hope. Get it? Sad, you see. Tough crowd today. Tough crowd. Ba-dum-bum. Psh. Now, why I think this is significant and interesting, right, is that previously you have the Pharisees getting in these debates with Jesus, right? Then the Sadducees come to work him over. And a lot of times, right, you think that the enemy of the enemy is your friend. Right? That the enemy of my enemy, you've heard that phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Right? That somehow someone that's against the person I'm against probably has something akin to me, you know, has some of my interests at heart, right? Maybe we share some sort of simpatico sort of posture. I don't think that's the case here, right? Jesus, it's interesting to note how quickly Jesus responds. He says, not the reason you're wrong. He sort of dismisses, you're wrong, you're mistaken, right? Because you neither know the scriptures nor the power of God. It's very suggestive. You neither know the scriptures nor the power of God. Now, I want to think about that for a second, but before we do, let me get back to this idea that the enemy of the enemy is not my friend idea, right? I think that to the Sadducees, right, Jesus probably looks like a Pharisee. Right, he clearly believes in the resurrection, right? He believes in things like angels, right? He clearly does not have a sort of he believes in the prophets. He doesn't have this desanitized faith that the Sadducees do, right? The Sadducees are much more concerned with simple Torah observance, right? They're not into the sort of later developments on Torah that the Pharisees are into, right? Now, to the Pharisees, some of Jesus' moves, right, like the way he dealt with the tradition, right, the way he kind of puts ethics first, the way he refuses to sort of take sides against Caesar, as we saw last week, right? Now, the Sadducees were not revolutionaries. Okay, so the fact that Jesus wasn't willing to sort of cast in with the political side, that probably made the Pharisees think he looks like a Sadducee to us. And so we might be tempted to think, well, Jesus is sort of part Pharisee, part Sadducee, right? It's like McDonald's. You take the hot side and, you know, the cold side, and you put them together, you know, and then you have, you know, the Sadducee side, the Pharisee side. But see, that's not at all the case. Jesus is something altogether different, unique, right, and transcends kind of either camp. And that's always the case, right? That's always the case when you become a follower of Jesus. Now, there's, because Jesus is the source of all truth, though, as Christians, we acknowledge, right? And because all truth is God's truth, right, that by God's grace, in every human ideology, in every human system, right, that captures, that's reasonable and kind of catches our imagination, our hearts, our affinity, there's probably some truth there, right? And all of us have sort of political opinions and cultural opinions and philosophies. But see, the danger is that when you see something in your own beliefs that lines up, that Jesus seems to line up with, that you think, oh, Jesus is like me then, right? That Jesus is like a conservative, right? Because he's really into morality, right? And he's into a sort of view of sexuality and things that rub against the currents of contemporary, modern, sort of sophisticated culture, right? Or because maybe you can clearly see that in the face of like liberal relativism, Jesus is somebody that says, hey, there's truth. And it matters. Now, let's say you're sort of a liberal, you know, cosmopolitan, like MSNBC person or something, right? And you look at Jesus and you say, oh, he's pro-poor, right? He's radical on equality, right? So then you start to say, oh, he's a Democrat. He's a liberal. He's a Democrat. He's a progressive, right? But see, he's really neither. And this is a real mistake, that when we see something, right, that we're drawn to in our own ideology that thinks Jesus is that ideology, right? And let me tell you how you know, I think, if you get this, okay? Or at least there's a hint that you get this. Let's say, like, you're a sort of cultural conservative sort of person, right? You're like the Fox News sort of person, you know, the Sean Hannity person, the Bill O'Reilly person. You'll find yourself inevitably in arguments with your MSNBC watching friends, if you have some. I hope you do, right? And that's, you know, to be expected. But do you also get in arguments with your conservative friends who aren't Christians or who are and have a really reductionistic view of the gospel? Do you find yourself equally uncomfortable among your MSNBC friends as you do among your Fox friends? Because the gospel doesn't allow you to fit comfortably anywhere. And vice versa, if you're the MSNBC New York Times crowd. Do you wind up being as critical of the ideology of the people you agree with a little more, but still, because the gospel is so unique, winds up making you kind of go back and forth with them and their ideology just as much as with the Fox News crowd? If that's the case, if your Jesus is neither a Sadducee or a Pharisee, a conservative or a liberal, right, a sort of secularist or traditionalist, if he transcends that, you're going to always be a little uncomfortable in any kind of ideological or cultural camp, right? You'll always find that none of this stuff, that Jesus can't be reduced to any of these human ideologies, right? Even though there are some things in them that are true, that Jesus will always rub up against them. So we have this dispute, right, with the Sadducees here, where we learn that Jesus is kind of none of the above. He says, the reason you're wrong, is that you neither know the scriptures nor the power of God. You neither know the scriptures nor the power of God. And it's an interesting sort of rhetorical progression. Oftentimes what we'll do, right, if we're in an argument with somebody, is we offer the reasons that we disagree with them, and then we think they're wrong, we're right. And then we'll say, case closed, right? Jesus sort of does the reverse here, right? He says, look, you're wrong, and here's why. But then goes to unpack it, right? You don't know the scriptures, right? First off, you don't accept the whole story, right? You don't accept the mystery and majesty of the manifold witness that God's given you in Holy Scripture, that's a multi-sided truth. A couple of weeks ago, Professor John Olaf was suggesting to us that one of the implications of our study of Mark is that we need to be people of the whole story, right? That we can't just be into sort of snippets and bumper stickers, right? We all have our favorite passages. We all have our favorite kind of ideas. But Jesus says here, you're captive to a reductionistic understanding of the Scripture. You don't know the Scriptures. Nor do you know the power of God. Right? Nor do you know the one that the Scriptures bear witness to. See, being a follower of Jesus, it's so much more than knowing the Bible. It's nothing less than that. But it's so much more. Because it's not just a list of propositions or something that you somehow ingest and memorize and now you have it. It's a relationship with the life-giving Lord. And see, what he's saying is on both counts, you're missing it. On both counts, you're in error. That you need both things if you're going to be a true child of Abraham. That these things come together to form a whole. So, in saying that, he goes on to then actually argue with them. So you think he's going to dismiss it, right? Hey, you're wrong. You know, it's like almost like my cousin Vinny, right? Like where he's done with the witnesses. All right, I got no more use for this guy, right? It sounds like that. It sounds like it's going to be a quick like dismissal, you know, witness, I'm done. But then he goes on to argue with them. And what's interesting, after he tells them, right, that they're in error, and here's why, because you need to accept a wider understanding of the Scriptures, and you need a higher and deeper understanding of the one to whom the Scriptures bear witness. He actually moves back onto the Sadducees' ground. He actually quotes, as Shauna read to us from Exodus, right? He says, "For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but they are like angels in heaven. And as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the passage about the bush, how God spoke to him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And again, we have, you are quite wrong. Now, Jesus goes back to the parts of the Scriptures that they honor. So you have this strange, usually in a culture like ours, right, that's bifurcated and divided, you have the people that are really the truth tellers, right? They tended not to be very empathetic, right? And then you tend to have the sort of people that want to honor all perspectives and how complicated discussion is, and so they're really sympathetic to where you're coming from, but they never get around to the truth. Jesus comes out and just says, hey, flat out, you're wrong, and here's why, here's the truth. But let me enter for a second after I've said what I think is the truth and get on your ground. I'm not going to start in some of the prophets you don't honor. I'll go first to the book of Moses and show you where you're wrong. But before we get into the substance of his response here, let's take a look at the intent of the question. So when you're reading this, right, you're thinking, why do they come up and pose this question about the seven wives? Or the seven husbands, right, with this one woman? Like, why? Like, this is really, like, you know, if you were watching a presidential debate and someone offered an argument like this, you would think, gosh, this person's crazy. They need new speechwriters, right? It was actually a really savvy move, because what the Sadducees were saying is Moses gave us this institution of levirate marriage, which is basically the idea that in an ancient culture where a woman, right, who was widowed, was completely bereft of social safety net sort of protections and would be really in trouble as far as traditional socioeconomic and cultural realities go. The law of Moses gives this protection that, hey, if this woman's husband dies, her brother has to marry her, right? Because she needs the protection of that household in order to pass an inheritance onto children, in order to have all the societal structures and things that make life have the possibility for blessedness, right? So it's actually a sort of social justice kind of practice that's instituted, right? So what the Sadducees do is come up with this bizarre hypothetical situation to say, okay, look, if you are like the Pharisees, believe in this idiotic doctrine, right, the resurrection, then what about this situation where this woman keeps marrying these brothers, and I don't know like what they're eating or what their cholesterol level are like. I mean, it's a hypothetical, so we don't have to worry about that. But and the brothers keep dying. Well, in your resurrection, Mr. Pharisee Jesus, who does she belong to? Whose bride is she? Answer is that. Case closed. So it's a question that's not really designed to elicit information. It's one, if any of you had ever done any teaching, right, it's one that's meant to embarrass the teacher, right, which is very common, and in some instances easy to do, right? So Jesus has two options, they think. He can either defend this inane doctrine, right, and try to come up and say, oh, well, actually, I guess it'd be the first one. I mean, you know, you have to go by chronology, or you go by the last one, right? Wherever the ink is wettest on the certificate, that's who she belongs to, right? You imagine, like, this sort of silly answer, right? Or he can say that he can sort of argue with them, and in arguing with them and trying to push against them, he'll make this practice of levirate marriage look silly. Right, so they figure that they can get him to make the law of Moses look stupid, like whatever he does, or he denies the resurrection and says, yeah, it really is a silly doctrine, and he winds up siding with them, right? So they spring this trap where they think Jesus really has no good options. Right? He's either going to side with us, or he's got to unpack this inane doctrine, and in doing so, he's going to show everybody, because he's got a popular following right now, how we're so much better than the Pharisees, right? We've got him. Then Jesus is like, as regard the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, right? But are like angels in heaven. We'll come back to that. But then he says, as for the dead being raised, haven't you read in the book of Moses, speaking about the burning bush, how God says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's the God not of the dead, but of the living. You ever think about this? Think about fairy tales, right? How does every fairy tale end? And they lived happily ever after, right? Do you ever wonder why fairy tales don't end? And they lived, and eventually the spouse got Alzheimer's, or, you know, one got a degenerative, the bride got a degenerative autoimmune disease, and she wasted away to nothing. And at the end of their life, they couldn't communicate anymore. Or their love was intense for a while, but then it lost enchantment, and somebody new moved in to the forest that caught the eye of the prince or something, and you know they just couldn't work it out anymore. Right? Why is that? Because even with creaturely love, when you take wedding vows, you know that love is meant to last forever. Right, that you can't bring yourself to think that it won't. Well, sometimes in a sinful, tragic world, it doesn't. But it's the exceptions that prove the rule. Right? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Right, they are. I am their God. I'm theirs. They're mine. When you use possessive pronouns, right, it's a very intimate relationship, right? I don't say, here's my Matt and Ashley Warren or something, right? Like, we just don't do that with friends, right? We only say, this is, you know, my daughter, this is my Mike, this is my Lisa, this is my Steve, right? This is my Shannon. When there's an intimate family relationship or a marriage relationship, right? And then when you start using those possessive pronouns, the thought that you would not be able to use them anymore is gut-wrenching. There's nothing more tragic than to say, I was once a mother. I was once a husband. I was once a wife. I was once a son or daughter. Because once you start using the possessive pronoun, right, that is meant to last forever. And when there's a binding, your and mine, this is why all the fairy tales end with happily ever after. Right? Because they don't even want to talk about, well, that happily for 20 years, then they died, or one died, right? Because in the moment of the exchange of the possessive pronoun, our imaginations can't bear to think that this is temporal. Should it be any less with God? Do we think God loves in a less intense or a less deep or a less lasting way? And this is what Jesus is saying. God has bound himself in covenant to the children of Israel. He's bound himself to Abraham, right? And when we bind ourselves, we do anything. Once we say, this is my spouse, my son, my child, we do anything to not have to suffer the turning of that possessive pronoun into past tense. Right? We always want it to be ever present. Now, if that's true for finite creatures, wouldn't it be true for God? And if God, who can do anything and promises that he will always be our God, and for God, who is always I am, right? Never I was or will be, always is I am. God transcends time, right? All of time is ever present to him. I think Jesus is saying, is there a way that this couldn't be true? Then because Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and David died, that God was the God of Abraham? No, he is. And because God is that way, and because of that covenant love, because he's the God of the living, those who are yoked to him, those who are in this possessive pronoun relationship, they can never be were. So Jesus says, even on the grounds of the only five books of the Bible you guys honor, you should know this. But see, you don't know the power of God. You don't know the mystery of God. And this, he says to the Sadducees, is why you're so confused. I recently reread The Velveteen Rabbit, right? Some of you know that children's story, right? But the rabbit, who's this little stuffed rabbit, is asking this old horse, like, how do I become real? Because he's so envious of the toys that have these moving electronic and mechanical parts. And he says, yeah, the problem with those toys is they break really easily. You know, they can't be worn like me, where the boy loves your fur off. When that happens, you become real. When the boy loves you. And of course, those of you who know the story, it's about the transformation of this rabbit from a stuffed toy rabbit to a real rabbit, who then spends his time dancing forevermore in the field with the real rabbits. Could it be any less so with God, Jesus is saying? When you're made real, really real, more real than we can imagine by his covenant love, do you think it could ever go past tense? Now let's go backwards a little bit, back to the line that I think gives us a radical hope. For when they rise from the dead, Jesus says, see, there's a two-stage argument. First off, I'm going to talk to you, Jesus says, like, Jesus actually does this one first, sort of reverse them, but Jesus is saying you're wrong on two points. You're wrong about the marriage thing, and here's why your inane trap is silly. Because in the resurrection, we won't give and be taken in marriage. And as regards your utter denial of the afterlife, and then he goes into the point we just talked about, right? But I want to go, I went backwards because I want to close with this because I think it's really significant. And it gives us a real picture of what the Christian hope is all about. They neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. Now, what's the nature of that like? Okay, I don't think it's meant to be a metaphysical like we become angels, right? Because angels aren't human beings, right? And what's clear from the resurrection of Jesus is still human. He's a glorified human, a different kind of humanity, but he's still human with a body. He can still eat. He can still touch people. Right? So, but I think he's saying the angels, it's a different... We are like the angels in that the angels don't marry and are not given in marriage. It's not that we become angels, but that likeness is the way we relate is different. The way we relate is different. In Revelation 16, 6 through 9, we hear this. Then I heard what seemed to be the voice of a great multitude, like the roar of many waters and like the sound of mighty peals of thunder, crying out, "Hallelujah! For the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory. For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. It was granted her to clothe herself with fine linen, bright and pure, for the fine linen and the righteous deeds of the saints." And the angel said to me, "Write this, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb." And he said to me, "These are the true words of God." Now here, the writer of Revelation, John, the writer, is giving us a picture of what the end of history will be like. And the end of history is a wedding feast. Right? And Jesus talks about this all the time in the Gospels. When he says, "What is the kingdom of God like?" He doesn't say, "Well, the kingdom is like sitting around a harp on a cloud playing a harp. It's like having a disembodied platonic soul that's immaterial and incorruptible, and then you sit contemplating the eternal realm of the forms or something." He doesn't say that. He could have. He didn't. He gives this very earthy analogies. It's like a wedding. It's like a wedding feast. Why is there no giving and taking of wedding vows? I heard a sermon years ago when the Da Vinci Code had come out. It was a Presbyterian pastor. Had a big church, and was very mixed theologically. So there's a lot of people who are taken by this. So his sermon title was Jesus Married? And he goes to the Da Vinci Code sort of arguments about Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And he said, in conclusion, the question was Jesus married? Of course. To all the covenant people of God. The reason why, I think, at the last day, there'll be no giving and taking in marriage is because everyone will be married at that day. That everybody will have and know the inviolable matrimonial bounds that can only exist when your partner is the God who is always I am. This is why weddings are really interesting. Once in a while, I perform weddings, right? And one of the things I like to do, so if I ever marry anyone in this room, it's going to happen, I guess. I mean, like, Mary, you perform the wedding. You know, like, my secret, so it won't be as neat. But what I like to do is when people are before me and I'm about to have them exchange their vows, what I like to have them do is turn around and look at everybody. Because, see, that group will never be together again. Right? That particular group of people will never be gathered with that couple again. And they're all there as witnesses and cheerleaders, right, to say, "We're for you." And then I have them turn back around, right? But what's so interesting, right, every marriage, you ever see, like, kids who play wedding, right? Little kids play, like, "Okay, you're the groom, I'm the bride," because they've seen a wedding, right? And it's funny, right? It's cute because they want to be married, and yet they have no idea what marriage involves, right? That's how every wedding is. It's like little kids in outfits that don't fit, right, saying vows they don't understand for a hope that they'll never truly experience. right? Because what every wedding is supposed to be is a foretaste on every marriage, on a good day. On a good day, it's to be the foretaste of this total joy, total security, total intimacy, total bond, total oneness, and yet a oneness that allows you to be you and me to be me, right? And that's so hard. And it's so hard. That's why, maybe by God's grace, you get glimpses of that with one person. And you got to work at it and be intentional about it, right? So really, every marriage is like kids playing at and rehearsal and training for a reality that will make the greatest moments of marital intimacy, the greatest moments of intimacy and disclosure, pale in comparison. This is why the Christian hope is so different, right? I think that what happens is there's two tendencies in Western culture, and probably in Eastern culture too, but people either generally say there's an afterlife, but they're kind of depressed about it, right? Because it's your soul in the disembodied realm of the forms or something, right? And so it's at least, hey, I'll be me, but will you really? Because you don't have your body and you can't kick a soccer ball or play a violin or taste a cheesecake, right? Or look at a sunrise ever again, but at least, hey, you're alive, right? So then what happens is people either embrace something like that or they wind up rejecting that and saying, well, hey, we all know that really embodied existence is really the only way to be us with a body. And so this is all there is. So we throw ourselves into it. And what Jesus is pointing to is a reality that's none of the above, saying that, hey, you will be re-embodied in a way, in a manner that transcends your hopes and dreams. So will it be disconnected from this life? No. Will it be without experiences of things like we experience in marriage, in relationships? No, it won't, but it'll be so much deeper in a way that transcends our imagination. Just like in the resurrection appearance of Jesus, right? He can eat and yet can walk through walls. Right? That there's this similarity and dissimilarity, right? But this is where Harrison's onto something. But what we can be sure of is that the saints in heaven now and us will all both share in that hope where one day we'll get our bodies again. But different kinds of bodies that don't corrupt, that don't give way to the vicissitudes of life, which in a moment can make the best day into a day that we never want to remember again. Jesus is offering a promise into something higher and deeper. So he's saying, yes, that this new life, the reason why there's not giving and taking in marriage is you don't understand the resurrection's just not a quantitative increase of life. You just don't get more days. It's a qualitative change in life. The very nature of life changes. And this changes how you relate to life, right? Because whether you're married or single, right? If you're married with family, what this means is you cannot make marriage an ultimate hope or reality. It's not. It's a good thing, and yet it's something which must give way to a better thing. Right. And it's also good on your tough married days, right? Can you say, hey, look, we know it's going to be tough, and yet we're training and being prepared for an intimacy which will make all the struggle worth it. There's a quote from Teresa of Avila, something like, one moment in the arms of Jesus will make all the sufferings of this life seem like a night spent in a bad inn or bad tavern. Right? And so that, and if you're single, right, you can take comfort because you're already married. Right, see what we do with single people in churches a lot of times, right? It's like you're sort of like in the to-be-married state, like you're not a full social creature. Well, no, see, everybody's a full creature because we are all betrothed to the Lamb. So if you're single, you shouldn't despair, right? And I'm not saying you shouldn't want to get married either, but also you have a completeness that comes. And so looking to marriage for completeness, right, is a sin for either the married or the single. right? Because it won't go. This is where Jerry Maguire says, from, right? You complete me. No. It's the Lamb that completes us. And by his grace, in human relationships, we can get glimpses of that. Real quickly, because we're running out of time, but I'll say one last thing. First Peter says this, right? Knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in the last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Who was foreknown for the foundation? The Lamb. The Lamb. Not an anonymous or ambiguous eternal son, but a son who was already Jesus. Not enfleshed, but whose destiny was already, even before you were created, to be your spouse. Who was already, before you were created, determined to be your covenant and hope. Now, why does that matter? Like, what's significant about that? Here's why. It's the reversal of every relationship anybody ever goes through, usually. What happens when you start dating and you want to marry somebody? You put on your best self, right? And the more the person likes that, right? You know, you put on your skinny jeans, or, you know, you spend more on your hair gel or whatever, right? Or you upgrade your wardrobe, and you really, like, try to take them around your cool friends, not the friends that are quirky, right? And you know, you sort of are on your best behavior. And gradually, the more relaxed you feel, the more the shadow side comes out. Because the hope is that they don't get too much of the shadow side until they take the vows and they're stuck with you. Right? And then you can relax. And then your person says, and then the person says, "You're not the one I married." And you're like, "Of course. Would you marry me if you knew?" Right? You're always playing this game of hiding until we can get to the security where we can get some eventual disclosure. With this, it's the opposite. See, he knew us at our worst. And before we were created and fallen into sin, before we even did the things and thought the things and felt the things that make us ashamed, he looked at us and said, "Mine, forever." C.S. Lewis says that God said in the Bible that we were gods, and he's going to make good his words if we let him, for we can prevent him if we choose. He will make the feeblest and filthy of us into a god or goddess, a dazzling, radiant, immortal creature, pulsating all through with such energy and joy and wisdom and love as we cannot now imagine. See, how we do relationships is we say, "Look, I'm going to try to present myself as a pulsating image of glory, right? And then once I've got you hooked, then you see, you know, how the realistic picture of me." Jesus says, "I've seen you at your worst and chosen to die for you." This is, Paul says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church." Died for you when you were alien, at your worst, when you didn't deserve it. So the freedom of knowing this resurrection nuptial reality is this, that you don't have to perform anymore. That you can live free. I don't know about you, but most of the times I look back on any given week and don't like the way I was, the way I acted, 9 out of 10 times, it was insecurity and feeling like I had to prove something and feeling like I wasn't loved. So much of our own sin and dysfunction, that's at the root of it, right? But when you know this, when you know that you don't have to prove anything anymore, when you know that you are already betrothed and destined for the wedding supper of the Lamb, and that it's not that you have to prove it and then you'll be betrothed, but in the betrothal, at your worst, that your bridegroom looks at you and says, "I'm going to make you into a best you couldn't ever hope or dream of." But it's true. Then you'll know why John says, "Happy are those who were called to the wedding supper of the Lamb." Amen.
we're going to share communion together. I was thinking about how Ashley invited us into the service this morning. She very clearly and firmly stated, you belong to God. We are God's. I really, really liked kind of that imagery of the intimacy that comes with getting to say, this is my son, this is my husband, this is my sister, this is, you get to say my. That's some intense love that God sheds on us. You are mine, and I'm going to make you whole. Also really love hymns. We don't sing them a lot. But this made me think of a hymn, so I just want to share that with you this morning. Kind of our response to that intense love that just gets poured out on us so